good people. You are listening to Feel Free to Deviate, the podcast about people, their careers, and their relationships with success. My name is Jim Turbert, and I am the host. The guest on this episode is photographer, educator, and photography book author, Sarah Malikoff. She is a professor at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth and also a bona fide fine art photographer. So what does that mean? Well, she doesn't shoot products or weddings or school kids or real estate listings. She did, however, photograph my cat once. If you would like to take a few moments to familiarize yourself with Sarah's work before listening, go to sarahmalikoff.com real quick, but make sure you come back. You can pause this or you can listen to me talk while you look at her work, but make sure you come back. Are you back? Pretty good stuff, right? This episode is art and photo heavy, but it's not a crazy deep art discussion. It really is mostly a career discussion. And if you have ever wondered about the experiences of university level art teachers, this is your chance to hear all about it. Even if you've never wondered about that particular sector, it's a great episode, and I think you might learn something. I had a good time. I'm pretty sure Sarah had a good time, and I hope some of that rubs off on you, dear listener. Side note, while editing, I realized that I at least partially misused the term catch-22. It irks me when people misuse words and phrases, and it irks me even more when the offender is me. I am very sorry. Okay, enough blabbing. Now it's time for the official blabbing. This is a spirited conversation with my friend, Sarah Malikoff.
I think of you as fairly put together.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah, I guess it's been too long.
I think I used to think of myself that way, but over the past couple of years, I've started to have doubts about my level of put-togetherness.
Yeah, well, that, you know, I think many people have over these specific past few years, and
yeah,
certainly me as well.
Yeah, why?
Just because I can't, as my sister says, I can't wear hard pants anymore.
Hard pants.
Which is just real pants.
Okay.
I have to be in the sweats if I'm home.
Well, I can't really relate because I always just wear jeans.
Well, I also consider jeans to be hard pants because, you know, they're comfortable, but still, you know.
Not that this has anything to do with anything, but I actually, the thing that I love about jeans, one of the many things that I love about jeans,
yeah,
is that they can be both hard and soft pants. They like there's nothing in the world like a brand new crisp pair of jeans. It's the greatest. But yeah, then when you put on the old jeans, it's like going home.
Any which way, maybe women's jeans are tighter, you know? I don't know.
Women's jeans are a much more diverse experience. The thing that I always notice about women's jeans is that the pockets are ridiculous.
In what way?
They're small.
Oh, yes.
Or some of them. I mean, they can be. Or they can be not even really pockets.
Useless.
They're just there for show.
Right.
They're like fake pockets.
I have pockets that are sewn up. Yep.
That's stupid. Why would you do that?
You know.
No, I don't.
Fashion at crazy standards. Who knows? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I'm glad that you're doing my podcast.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if you're glad after.
Of course, I'm already glad. It's already going smashingly well. I mean, not only am I glad to be talking to you, but I'm also glad because I haven't done a photo/art episode in a while, I'm excited for that.
Oh, good. Yeah, I've heard a few. I heard Judy's and Dave's.
Yeah, those guys are into art.
Yeah, they are.
Did you listen to the Arna one?
No.
You should listen to the Arna one. I mean, well, maybe not. I don't know.
I will.
You're actually mentioned in it. You and Andrew both are mentioned in it.
Oh.
I feel like that one is it's kind of a sleeper.
I'll check it out specifically.
I recommend it to everybody listening. Speaking of art in Boston photo, I had a dream recently where Steve Terlentes was critiquing my podcast.
And what did he say?
He's just like, I'm not sure what I'm getting out of this. That was basically the crux of his critique. What am I supposed to be getting out of this? And I'm just, I don't think it was actually, I mean, I have no idea how Steve would feel. He probably hasn't listened to it, but I'm guessing that it has more to do with my own personal anxieties and doubts.
Oh, for sure. That's what dreams are about.
Or maybe it's just a sign that I need to ask Steve to come on as well.
Right. And then he can have a chance to say, wait, what? I don't know what I'm getting out of this.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not sure what he would get out of it either, except for the joy of talking to me.
Right. It is joyous.
It's fun, right?
It is. It is.
So far, we're having a good time.
I know. I like you're in my head.
That's where I should be.
Jim is in there.
Sarah, why don't you introduce yourself?
Oh, my God. Well, this is a tough one. I am an artist / photographer / educator. Is that enough?
Yeah, that is definitely how I think of you, or at least partially. Is that how, like when you're at a party, when people say, oh, what do you say?
Okay, in that little nugget, I probably just say photographer. And then they don't understand that either, because then they think,
yes,
I shoot weddings or something more commercial. It's not always easy to explain that that's not what it is. And I hate the phrase fine art photographer or fine art or art, you know, just even saying I'm an artist. I mean, it's true, but I don't know. People have some weird associations depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah, I guess it also, yeah, it depends on what kind of party it is too.
Yeah, exactly.
For instance, I know that you work at part of the UMass system.
Yes.
If you're at a function, like an all-school function, and there are other faculty members, you know, donors or board members or parents or whatever there, I would imagine that some people get it and some people are like, that's interesting.
That is correct. That is correct. There's faculty in other fields that definitely have the impression that photography is just a technical skill. And how is that even in the art department? Possibly, they might say. And then within the art department, there are some people outside of photography who say photography is pressing a button. So there's some really old, outdated opinions around, but then there's plenty of people who appreciate it, I think.
Yeah, I think for the most part, it's just sort of ignorance. When I tell people that I went to art school, they often immediately assume that I'm a painter.
Right.
And then if I say, oh, no, I don't do that, then they assume that I went for graphic design because that's a viable field for earning money.
Right. Right. And you mentioned parents, of course. And, I just did an open house the other day. And, you know, and rightfully so, they want to know what are the marketable skills if their kiddo goes and gets, you know, a photography major. I understand that. And there's lots of things to talk about in that way.
So what do you tell them?
Oh, man. I just said there's lots of things to talk about. And then every time I stumble over it. But you know, it's like I do have students who've gone on to be wedding photographers or have their own studio. Even some of the skills in terms of design, whether it be website design or other design, or I have students who work in the medical fields, you know, using photography in hospitals, and there's all kinds of things.
You know, there are a bazillion applications for photography, but you went to an art school. I went to an art school.
Yeah.
I assume that the program at UMass is an art school program. And there's a difference between an art school photography education and a practical photography education. You can argue that one is better than the other for this, that, or the other thing. But in general, I feel like a lot of the super technical stuff kind of gets crammed into an art education, or it's left up to the student to sort of discover the technical stuff that they want to deal with. Whereas if you go to a practical photography school, it's just like, this is 100% technical and we don't care so much about the content. I'm just wondering how
I think
reconcile that if they end up working as a real estate photographer.
Right. Oh, and that is another. I have several students doing that quite successfully. I think the thing is, you know, the things that we stress in the art school photography are the things that you really develop in that kind of school environment. So critical thinking, and reading photography. And we do learn technical things, and we don't go over every piece of gear in the world, but you can learn that. Once you know the basics, you learn what you're going to use. That anybody can do.
But I'm just gonna throw this out there to sort of illustrate a possible difference. In Boston, there are a lot of schools. You're aware of this.
Yes.
There are a lot of photo schools. There are a lot of photo programs in Boston. Boston's a big photo city, and you can go into any number of bars, restaurants, or cafes and see weirdly curated student shows.
Yeah.
Up on the wall. And often, or sometimes, and I don't want, this isn't a disparaging remark about a certain group of students, but there is a practical photography school in Boston called NESOP.
It doesn't exist anymore.
All right. Well, it was a place where you could go and learn all the technical stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember one of my teachers at Mass Art disparagingly talking about going in and seeing these student shows and seeing wonderful, wonderful prints of the most boring photographs they've ever seen in their lives.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think a lot of people talked about that, and I think there was a truth to that. I also think that, you know, there were good students there, and I know people, I know people there who are making really interesting
photographs.
So, yeah. So, no, but I know what you're saying. There definitely was sort of a reputation and a talk about that. And frankly, you could be someone not very imaginative and do well there.
Very well.
Yeah.
And also make a ton of money.
And go on to make a ton of money. Exactly. Exactly. It's just not your thing to be, you know, creative or
right.
Whatever you need.
Well, I feel like some people use it as a stepping stone. Like they get the technical stuff and they do also have ideas, and sometimes they go on to another program or they just develop it on their own.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not everybody.
That's true.
I don't know. Where am I going with this? I'm just...
I don't know.
Anyway, what exactly is... What's your deal with photography? I know that you've been photographing for a really long time, and I know that you're singularly focused on photography. I want to talk about what goes along with that, but I'm also just curious what did you want to be when you were a kid? Did you always want to be a photographer?
Not specifically. I would say that I knew I wanted to do something creative. You know, even as a kid, I thought, well, what is the practical application of this? And I thought I might do advertising, you know, not knowing what that was.
Yep.
But I knew I wanted to do something in the arts. And I was lucky to have photo classes in high school and, you know, fell in love with it by doing it. But it wasn't like I was like, I mean, I was excited to take a photo class, but I wasn't like, this is going to be my career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But after high school, then you went to school.
I went to school, yeah.
And you kept photographing.
I did. I went to, you know, a liberal arts college, again, thinking, not being sure what I was going to do. And I do have an interest in other things and the world. And I was excited to take, you know, not only English classes and humanities, but like I jumped into bio as a freshman.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why.
Liberal arts.
I'm not sure why. I wasn't even required to. But then I became a studio arts major with an emphasis in photography. Just there wasn't the specialization that you might have in an art school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The major would be studio arts, and then you would have a concentration, and mine was photography.
Okay.
But, you know, I see the requirements that my students who are earning a BFA with a photo major, and they have a lot more in-depth requirements than the BA had at a liberal arts school. For what it's worth, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think it's interesting because I know that you went to some fancy schools, dare I say?
You could say that.
You went to fancy high school, and you went to fancy college, and I know that your sister is a medical professional.
She is.
And I'm curious, were your parents bugged out by their fancy school going daughter majoring in art?
Well, yes, but I will also say that they weren't so into me going to a fancy school that, well, with high school especially, I kind of weaseled my way into that. I didn't weasel my way into that school. It was my motivation to apply and get accepted to that school, and then I was incredibly lucky to have the school provide the financial needs. So while it was a fancy school, I was not there from parental pressure or parental finances. It's tricky. This is like family baggage and stuff. My father, I think, wanted to be an artist and specifically a photographer, which I didn't know when I was in high school.
Oh, wow.
And he was forced by his parents to do something more practical. And he wanted to be an art history major, and he ended up being, I don't even know what, some computery thing, ending up in a corporate job where he was miserable. I don't know. I think he didn't want me to do it, and part of him did want me to do it, but was maybe, very scared. He was discouraging, let's
Wow.
say that, about pursuing that.
Man, I wish I could talk to your dad.
My dad is no longer with
I'm
us
aware of that.
for a long time.
I bet it would be an interesting conversation, though.
It could be. It would wig me out just to have you talk to my
We
dad.
could have a
So,
round table. We could all just sit down together.
not the thing I would wish for you, Jim.
Well, but that's I think that's also interesting because we were just talking about all the practical applications for having a photography degree, and then you took your photography degree as far as it could go, and you are a photographer, specifically a fine art photographer, whether you want to identify as that or not. That's
Yes.
how the world would identify what you do.
I will admit to that. Yeah.
But you're not making your living as a fine art photographer. The catch 22 of this is that you still need to find another job, whether it's photographing weddings or real estate or whatever. I know that.
Yes.
I mean, I used to work at the website company, and every day I would look at hundreds of photographer websites, and some people, I'm sure, have fine art backgrounds, but on their website you would never know it because it's just 10 different categories of every type of photography that's possible. They're just like, please hire me to do something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, is that why you are an educator, or is there some passion? Are you deeply passionate also about educating?
That's an interesting question. Because I think it's changed over time. I think that when I decided to pursue teaching, I was still in grad school, and it seemed like the thing people tried to do. And, there's easy things to say, like you have summers off, you have more time to do your own work than if you had a 9-to-5, year-round job. I mean, that's true to some extent. That's certainly not all of it, and you're actually busy with a lot of school commitments year-round. But anyway, I didn't think I had some passion for education. I mean, as you mentioned, I came from a very academic background, and I thought there was some cachet or prestige to being a professor that, or being part of an academic community was appealing, certainly, and I was used to that community. But mostly it was like this, yeah, mostly it was like this is something that I can do with my education and my passion for photography and make money. And then by doing it, and it's really hard when you start, just real so like you're either gonna pour your heart and soul into it, or not, and probably not continue. I learned that I liked it. It's rocky at first. For me, it was. I don't think it came naturally. I think it does to some people, but not to me. But yeah, then there's parts of it, not all of it, there's parts of it that are quite rewarding and fulfilling. And sometimes I have to remind myself of that.
Are you saying that all of it's not 100% completely rewarding all the time?
Yeah.
Because most jobs are.
Yeah, I know. I know. It is no different than any other job with its highs and lows.
I'd say that it's a little bit different than some other jobs simply because you really get to impact people. You know, maybe not everybody, but you have the potential to make a big difference in somebody's life.
Yeah, and that is definitely one of the rewarding things. And yes, that wouldn't be a specific rewarding thing in other jobs necessarily. I talk about photo all day, except when I don't, except when it's the other administrative and more student problems and things like that that take over some of your time.
I need this to graduate sort of things, or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's rote advising things. There's also committee work. There's also, you know, students having issues, I think, always, but especially, you know, COVID, post-COVID, students are struggling a little more. Mm. And that, you know, sort of colors everything.
Right. Do you notice that the psychological state of the students is precarious?
Yes.
In general.
Yes.
In general?
No, I think it's worse. I think it's worse right now. Everybody in the world dealt with this huge anxiety, and, you know, it impacted social skills and, you know, attention and focus and family pressures, and I don't know, just that there's, you know, it doesn't affect everyone, but I would just say I have students that are struggling more than usual.
What do you tell them?
I don't know. It depends. It's hard. You know, I'm not a therapist.
No.
Though I sometimes feel like I'm treated one as one. Anyway, it's just, you know, trying to get them back on track with their work and to be focused on their work.
You mentioned that in the beginning of the teaching process experience, it's very difficult. I'm not a teacher and I never have been, but I'm friends with lots of teachers. And
yeah.
And
yes, you are.
And I have a lot of art teachers, specifically other teachers too, but mostly art teachers. When you said it was hard, you talked about how you weren't sure that it was for you, but you discovered that you really liked it. When you initially said that you thought it was hard, I was immediately thinking about the whole adjunct teaching system, because that's the part that always seemed to be the most stressful for me, not the actual doing the job, but the getting the job and getting some sort of some sort of permanence. How did that affect the process of your relationship with teaching?
I mean, for sure, that's really hard starting out, unless you just are incredibly lucky, but it's tricky. And I think it's only getting harder. Yeah, you are in a situation for the first few years where every year you're applying for jobs because you get a job and it's for a year.
Or a semester.
Or a semester. They end for a number of reasons. You know, you might just get one class one semester and then it's enrollment dependent and it might not go on. I mean, in a sense, I was lucky. I got a lot of one-year visiting professor jobs, which is great in that it's, you know, full-time or almost full-time at one place, but it is specifically for 1 year. That, you know, they use those positions to get new people in. A lot of times it's younger people, you know, who are getting experience.
Mm-hmm.
But every year is the grind again of sending out your materials, updating your materials, interviewing every year for those jobs.
You get really good at interviewing, though.
Oh, man. Finally, I did. I was terrible. I think that was made it really hard at the beginning. I mean, that's what made teaching really hard for me at the beginning, is I'm not like a naturally gifted speaker.
If you want a fine job today.
I don't know. I don't know. But, you know, you learn with practice, but it took me some years to feel comfortable in an interview and actually feel like I was making any sense.
I've been interviewing a lot lately, and I think that I am good at talking.
You are.
But you know what my problem is?
No.
Everybody hates me. It's my personality. They hate me.
That's not
Nobody
true,
wants
though.
To give me a job.
Well, I don't think if they don't want to give you a job, it's your personality.
Oh, no. It's my
You
it's
have
my,
a fan club.
It's my stellar hey. Resume.
Hey, what about the Jim Turbert fan club?
What about it? But yeah, that was a joke.
Oh.
Dun, 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 dun.
No, I'm a member.
Yeah, that's I don't really do much art anymore, but for a while I did that. And I suppose doing this stuff takes up a lot of the time and energy that would go into that. But I did bust out my 4x5 recently. I didn't use it. I was going to but I busted it out and I'm inching closer to using it. I'm going to take some pictures of the kids and see what happens after that.
Yeah, you should. I've been liking the photos you've been making, even though they're not 4x5.
No, they aren't. I have a ton of film in the fridge, and some of it is the Polaroid positive negative, which has been discontinued for a long time. I could probably sell it for like $5,000 because
yeah.
the people who love that stuff truly love it, and it's just been in my fridge. But at this point, yeah. I feel like I need to use it for something special.
Yeah.
I just need to get over the preciousness and just use it and do something with it.
Yeah. Well, and you know this because we were talking about digital cameras when I bought my first digital camera. We have the same camera. Do we still?
We still do, unless you got a new one.
No, I don't have a new one. It's kind of changed things. I was so resistant, but, and I don't love everything about it for sure.
Nope.
Just the flexibility. Mm-hmm. And being able to try things that I wouldn't try if, like you just said, the preciousness mm-hmm. of film and cost and time. I can try so many different things in the amount of time that I have and just try wacky things that I never would with film. So I'm liking that part of it.
I don't know that I've seen any. I haven't gone to your website for a while. You know what? I guess that makes me a bad podcaster because I didn't go to your website before I did this.
Yeah, Jim.
I shouldn't have admitted that.
You've seen work of mine that is digital, you know, whether you know it or not, because it's all.
I didn't know it.
You didn't know it, which is good.
Yeah. If you have one of these good cameras and you know how to use it, they're amazing.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. And I could have a better one. I should upgrade.
What are you thinking about?
I don't know. You know, it's like I go through the, I'm not a tech geek, but then I can talk to you
yeah.
and start totally geeking out.
You're kind of,
get
like
excited.
A closet tech geek.
I am, but only with certain people and only when I have like a very specific, like in general, I don't care. But then I'm like, oh, I think maybe I need a new camera. And then I really care that I get the best thing.
Yeah. And you are one of the unique cases where the super high megapixel cameras make sense.
Yeah.
And they're starting to get real big.
Yeah. And that's why I could upgrade. Just mine is a few years old at this point.
I feel like 60, I mean, we're talking about in the price bracket of the camera that we both have, the
right.
fancy Sony cameras. I think that both Canon and Sony have 60 some odd megapixel cameras that are in the same price bracket as the camera that you have.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's just that they're good. The point is that they're good. Most people don't need the high megapixels, but obviously if you're making large art prints that may or may not be stitched together, I don't know, are you stitching? Or do you not want to talk about that?
No, that's fine. I don't stitch usually. I mean, I've done it a couple times when I really can't back up far enough. Normally I'm not and still getting pretty good results. I'm in small places, you know, shooting inside and have a wide angle lens and yeah, I haven't found too much need for it. Well, you were talking about, you know, it being so hard because of the adjuncting thing or the impermanence, the whole teaching thing.
Yes.
But also it's weird because I mean, this is how I feel about it. Nobody teaches, like you learn in grad school to be a photographer and to be an artist, but you don't learn how to be a teacher.
Right.
And I mean, that wouldn't be true if you were, you know, getting your teaching certificate and going to teaching school and, you know, studying pedagogy.
Yeah.
But to be a professor in many fields, I feel like you're just kind of thrown in to the teaching part of it and you you just find your way. You figure out what works and doesn't work. And you have your network of friends that, you know, do it and give you advice.
Yeah, of course.
But
syllabi and such.
Yes, everybody's trading syllabi. All the syllabi are Frankenstein, you know, of all your friends.
Yeah. But a lot of people do TAing as well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I didn't do that much. I was a TA one semester in grad school, and then I taught a 16 millimeter filmmaking class.
Awesome. I would totally take that class.
I know. That was fun, and I miss that. But with that, you're just kind of thrown into it, too.
Yeah.
At least that was my experience.
Well, I can imagine that's kind of weird. In some cases, you're not even that much older or experienced than the undergrad students that you're
starting off.
It's like some of them might actually be older than you in some cases, especially at art school.
Yeah, no, I still have that. I mean,
oh, really?
I'm not young anymore, but I definitely have students that are older than me.
Okay, yeah. Nice. Yeah, I mean, it happens a lot. There are often older students in art programs.
Yeah.
Whether they're lost souls or just like lawyers who decided to go back and learn about art.
There's all kinds of fascinating reasons, actually. You know, some of them are quite interesting and bring a lot to the classroom. Yeah.
At MSR, I used to enjoy the fact that the grad students worked in basically the same space. Yeah, they had the grad studio. They were printing in the same place. Like, so... if you were color printing, everyone's outside waiting for prints and you get to interact with all these grad students of varying levels of experience. And it was really great because some of the grad students are like, when you're in your early 20s and you're talking to like a 35-year-old grad student,
mm-hmm.
that's a pretty valuable resource. And a lot of the time these people have degrees in other things. Like, so I remember listening to crazy conversations about world history and politics and all kinds of stuff. So like, just being exposed to that was a huge part of my education as well.
Yeah. No, for sure. It's literally just yesterday I was thinking about, probably because I was knowing that we were going to talk, but thinking about starting out with teaching, and a good friend of mine in grad school was a bit older, Jim Fawcett. I don't know if you ever met him.
It doesn't ring a bell.
But he was... super experienced, had been a newspaper photographer. And I mean, he just knew a lot of stuff about life, you know, photography and networking and so much of my early teaching, whether it's like getting, like he got me jobs basically, or, you know, was a role model of how to do the job and also how to hustle. He would hustle and, you know, be teaching all over the place. So not that that was the fun part, but, you know, going to New Hampshire, you know, from Boston, going to New Hampshire one day, Rhode Island the next day, and maybe throw Maine in there.
No, for real. Like, that's like, you know, Yoav as well, right?
Yeah.
Like, that dude was all over the place. I think he's settled now, but he was all over the place for a little while. He was teaching in New York City. He was teaching in Maine. Yeah. He was teaching in Boston, probably in Rhode Island too. I don't know.
Yeah.
People go all over the place. It's nuts.
I don't miss the days when I had to file tax returns in like four states.
Well, I mean, for the most part, though, you were pretty lucky. I mean, I remember you worked at in Maine for a while, right? Like regularly.
I did. I mean, I had.
But mostly, it was around the Boston area. Mostly.
No, I feel like it's really not. The jobs I had in Boston were kind of in between jobs at the art schools in Boston, Museum School, Mass Art, and you know, places like that. What is it? It's now Leslie, that Art Institute of Boston. It was. And those were like fill-ins when things went wrong, but mostly like my full-time jobs were 4 years in Maine at two different schools, and then a couple years at Brown.
Oh, I forgot about that.
In Rhode Island. Yeah, you said I was super lucky to get those, but I was still living in Boston. So
that the thing that always struck me about that class of educational worker, they're like migrant farmers of education. Like some people just up and leave. They go to the big conference. What's it called?
CAA. Took me a minute.
They go and try to get a job anywhere in the country, and then they'll just move to like Texas or something.
Yeah.
And
I consider doing that. I got a couple job offers over the years, you know, for tenure track jobs. And I was like very close. And then I was like, I can't do it. I can't move there.
Yeah, I think that really thins out the pack, because people just can't keep that up forever, especially once you get into your 30s and 40s. Yeah. Maybe even later. I don't know.
It does get more tiring, and you just get tired of it. I mean, yeah, sure, it's being older, but it's also like
I've just paid
my dues. I've done this long enough.
So many times.
Yeah. So, I mean, so I don't work in Boston now. I mean, I'm super lucky and I love my job, but my commute is still, you know, over an hour each way. But the thing I always say, because for so many years, commuting to my job meant spending the night or right. multiple nights away from home, you know, for years now, I've been saying, at least I sleep in my own bed at night.
It's a bonus.
It is.
Because I've talked about education so many times on this podcast. I have no idea if you've been listening, so you possibly don't know, but I talk about education a lot, and the idea of the importance of degrees comes up a lot. And you have a master's degree in fine arts. It's a fancy pants degree, and it is required by most institutions if you want to teach. But let's say you're not teaching and you're just art person. An artist, they call them, I believe.
Oh, I know where this question is going.
Do you though? I don't know. Maybe you do.
Keep going.
All right. It's a two-pronged question. Are you encouraging your students to pursue a master's degree in photography or fine arts? And let's just start with that.
Sort of. It is. It's so tricky because there is a lot of value in doing it. I found, you know, it sounds so cliche, but like grad school were some of the best years of my life, you
right.
know, but creatively and socially. And it was really great. I mean, I happened to find a community that I could really feel a part of, which is not easy for me in the rest of life. I didn't have that even in college, where I felt that way. I mean, the museum school is a really special place, but there's a lot of debt that comes with that.
So much.
And for me, obviously, it was worth it because it's necessary for my career, which I'm happy with. And I think it would be useful in other careers. It gets trickier the more the debt rises and the teaching jobs shrivel. It's harder to say, yeah, you should definitely go to grad school.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Because all the reasons that you just said are great reasons, especially when you added the fact that you find it difficult to find that sort of community.
Yeah.
It's like you're entering a curated community.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
a sense. And as I mentioned before, just being surrounded by these people with other experiences, that was maybe just as valuable as being in the school itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I definitely understand that. I'm asking because there are obviously people, and rightfully so, who suggest you can get, you know, the same education on your own by practical real world experience or going to the library or whatever. And to a certain extent,
yeah
I mean, especially in the technical stuff, that's
right.
True.
Right. The technical stuff is true.
Or the reading list is pretty easily accessible.
The reading list, but then who do you talk about it with?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's part, you know, it's finding your people, but it's also finding the people that you can, you know, share your work with and mm-hmm. critique with and discuss the readings with and, you know, and obviously have the professors that,
yeah.
guide that, you know. I think you know, and we started off talking about that, the difference between, like, you can teach yourself the technical stuff and you can you can engage in ways to learn the other things or engage with the other things, but it's just kind of set up for you that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If you're fortunate enough to live in a city like Boston, or I know that there are other organizations, and I think there's one in Houston and Pittsburgh, there are institutions like the Photographic Resource Center, where you can become a part of a community that way.
Mm-hmm.
They arrange things and they have portfolio reviews and they have discussion evenings and whatnot.
That's true.
But I don't know if every city has something like that.
Yeah.
I know that there are photo clubs all over the place, but like, I don't know, it always, the idea of a photo club always seemed kind of weird to me, unless I knew people in it.
Yeah. From the outside, it seems a little weird. It may be great, and there may be great ones.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
When I hear photo club, I think like, oh, look, pictures of birds.
I think some of them have that. Yeah. I mean, depends on who is involved.
Of course. Yeah, this isn't so much the second prong of that question. I don't know. I feel like there's a certain snobbery around the master's degree as someone without a master's degree.
Yeah, do you?
And I'm just wondering, I remember, you know, Dave, our mutual friend, Dave.
I do.
he was telling me at some point, or maybe it was he and Cassie were talking about it, and that one of his or their mentors basically told them that as the holder of such a degree, you need to convince yourself of its importance.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's worthless.
Well,
I'm paraphrasing. I don't think that's the way that they put it. That's the way that I interpreted it.
Okay. I get that. I think you could say that about a lot of choices in life.
I think you're probably right.
And, you know, whatever else I can convince myself of that it was useful, I know for a fact that I wouldn't have my job if I didn't do it.
10-4.
So there, you know, there's a very concrete... Now, I mean, but again, as you said, like a lot of people aren't going to go on to teaching. So it's a different, you know, not that it's less useful, but there's a very concrete reason that I'm using it and that it feels... necessary.
Well, I don't think that the other reasons you mentioned are bad reasons. I think they're perfectly good reasons. It's the same with any degree, really. Like, yeah, you could go teach yourself how to do all kinds of stuff. Also, some people are just better at doing that than others.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't want to say hand-holding, but some people just need more guidance or at least to get pushed in the right direction.
I mean, I wish it wasn't such high stakes, right? You know, unless you can get, you know, a fellowship somewhere, which is fairly difficult, I think, in photography. Uh-huh.
Well, there are only so many.
Right. It just becomes really high stakes. But I don't think it's necessary, as you mentioned.
To be an artist,
right.
But it's nice to be bona fide.
Well, that may be part of what you were referencing with the, like, you convince yourself that it was worth it.
Well, it also convinces some other people. It immediately shows some people that you've jumped through a certain number of hoops that means that you're not incompetent, you know?
I guess. I don't know if I find that outside of my job, I don't know that many people are impressed that I have an MFA. I don't know. I guess it just doesn't come up.
I always wanted to go get one, but then that window just sort of closed. I decided it was no longer worth it for my time or money.
And I think that's a very fair decision.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I still wanted to go.
Yeah.
I mean, not because I have the inability to learn or to find people to talk about art with, but because I feel like I've always wanted a mentor and I haven't had one since maybe I was a tween.
It's funny you say that because I never felt like I had a mentor. Even going to
Dude, what's his name? Jim Fawcett sounds kind of mentory.
Oh, well.
Was that his name?
Yeah, Fawcett. I mean, he was a good friend, which doesn't mean he can't also be a mentor. You know, he was a fellow student who, you know, had different. Yeah, no, he was a student. But again, he was older and had, you know, really specific life experience that he shared and helped some of us. But I mean, I guess that's the point, is that the community, like by saying I didn't have a mentor doesn't mean I didn't have great professors, but I just didn't have one that I bonded with, you know. I feel right. Lucky, and I'm still in touch with a lot of my professors or people who were around that community at that time.
What about books?
I like books.
Yeah. You made one and you're making two.
I'm making my second book as we speak. I don't know. I love books. It's funny. I was going to mention, we were talking about grad school and community. And one of the things I so loved, my job was working in and then basically running the library at the museum school.
When you were
in
grad school.
And after, that was my first real job, you know, when I became full time. And head of that library. The library was like an offshoot of the museum library. So I did not have a library degree. I never got one, but right. I was sort of managing the museum school side of it and just could be with books all day long and pick new books and direct people to books they would like. Yeah. So I just always loved art books as a way to consume art, as you know.
Did you grow up with them?
No. No. I always kind of love libraries. I mean, I'm a geek in that way. But I think art is something, you know, you have exhibitions and those are great and you strive for those. And I love making the object, you know, that goes on the wall. And that is really different than its presence in a book. But it is a more accessible or a more portable and consumable, you know, way to look at art, a way to return to it over and over again.
It's also a very specific way to present your art.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, the sequence becomes more important.
Yeah,
but I love going back to a book. You know, it's like I see an exhibition and I'm floored, but I don't often go multiple times and see new things. But you can definitely do that with a book.
Yeah, especially if it's not in your city. You know,
right.
You know, if it's...
Right. Yeah, so it's just, it's different because it's not the same as the, you know, crafted object. And a lot of people talk about how photography books are closer to photography than, say, a book on a painter or a sculptor. And I get that photographers kind of think in that way and that a photograph is fairly well represented in a book. I'm still pretty attached to my own printing and crafting of the photograph, you know, which is different.
Yeah, it's different, but of course it's hard to separate looking at photographs printed in books or newspapers or magazines. It's like it's just part of culture.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas paintings don't have that, you know, you don't look at a book with actual paintings.
Right, right.
Because photographs are reproducible in the ways that they're reproducible.
Right.
It's not a photograph of a photograph. I mean, in some cases it is, but it's different than a reproduction of a painting in a book.
Right.
It can be its entire purpose, in fact, you know?
Like, I know. And I mean, a lot of that is obvious. I mean, this is on my mind.
It's not obvious. It's not. Well, I don't think that it is. I don't think that most people give it a second thought.
Maybe.
I think it's important to state these simple ideas. Because
I think photographers give it a lot of thought.
Yes. But believe it or not, most people listening to this probably aren't photographers.
Fair enough. Well, and you know, these things are on my mind. As you said, I'm making my second book, and I literally got back. I was in Germany on press while the book was being printed a week or two ago. It's really exciting to see the work be printed, and I think it looks good. I'm happy with the way it's turning out. But and this is, again, being technical and geeky about it, you know, the color range is not the same on a CMYK press as a continuous tone, you know, C print. So, you know, blah, blah, blah. They look different, but I think I'm excited for it. It'll be good.
Well, what is the new book? All right. Well, first, what's the first book? What's the first book and what's the second book? Are they related or is it a different project or?
They are related in that. You mentioned one thing you said a while ago was I am singularly focused.
well,
and you meant on photography.
I didn't just about photography.
Oh, you meant what I'm going to say?
Well, go ahead.
I have always been interested in exploring interior space and specifically domestic interior space. Not that I have never photographed other things or I wouldn't photograph other things, but it has kind of been my obsession or compulsion for many years to look at the ways that we arrange our things. Like, what is it that we collect? How do we display it? What do we hide? All those kinds of things, like just notions of home, you know, separating us from the outside world, but also the ways that we bring in representations of the outside outside world. So, for example, the first book was called Second Nature, and it was these interiors. You know, I love color. They're large format, colorful, and focusing on representations of nature within a home. So I'm trying to think of like a pithy example. You know, the cover is this kind of modern looking sofa in a living room with a big picture window behind it where you can see the landscape outside. It's hazy and overexposed, so it's less real than the inside. And inside, you know, there's a large house plant, but then this replica of a canoe that is a coffee table. Somebody thought to make a coffee table out of a little canoe.
Because they're outdoorsy.
I mean, you know, it's quirky and it's fun, but in context of, you know, finding things over and over again, I think I was trying to make a point about this need to live around nature, but often it's in this very controlled way, somewhat artificial way, when the stuff is right outside the window. But, you know, we need to be protected from the elements and locking other people out of our space.
Mm-hmm. Keep them out.
You know, all the functions that a home has.
Yeah.
literally. So carpets that are made to look like rocks and patios, or trying to think of other examples that are in there. Oh, there's a famous example of, it might have been in your home, of your cat with her whale pillow in, you know, this white cat in a white room. I like that photo.
Yeah, me too. I'm a little biased.
No, you're biased, but a lot of people like that photo.
Yeah, well, Bea is a superstar. Was a superstar. She's no longer with us.
Yes, R.I.P. Yeah. Bea.
But you guys should come visit again so you could photograph the new cat.
I want to.
Also, it's a different space. That was at our apartment. This is our house.
Yes.
But whatever, it doesn't matter.
But yes.
I'm just joking about that. But go on about the book. I'm sorry for derailing you.
No, that's fine. Well, that was the first book. So they're interiors and they have a certain look. I'm looking for certain things, patterns, you know, formally color and patterns and perspectives within the room with this thread or this theme of representations of nature. After that, the way I come up with ideas, I guess, or themes is just by shooting what I want to and then noticing what keeps popping up. So I started noticing that I was drawn to the portraits that people put on their walls. Mm. So who are they? Because sometimes they're family members, sometimes they're, you know, ancestors, older, more distant family members, but then celebrities or historical figures, you know, pets, certainly. So I sort of started looking for those. And that was a series called Interior Portraits, you know, again, with the double entendre in my titles. I hate my titling, by the way. So just
okay.
it's a huge part of like, okay, I have this idea and I'm putting these images together, and then a title is important, and I'm just pretty bad at it. So yeah, interior portrait being, I'm literally looking at the portrait in the interior, but then again, the interior is functioning as a portrait of the person who lives there as well.
Yeah.
So working on that, I kept finding what I thought were pretty interesting and sometimes humorous portraits of like, why does somebody have a portrait of George Washington in their bedroom?
That's a great question.
And it's fascinating to me. And again, kind of humorous. So I started finding things like that. And, you know, and again, first the portraits that kind of came off the tail end of that other project, and then other things as well. So, you know, a bust of Caesar, or trying to think of other things. You know, a chair that's upholstered with drawings of Paul Revere's ride. You know, these are all things that I photographed for the new book, the title of which is Personal History. not my history, not my personal history, but the fact...
But it's personal.
Well, people's spaces are personal. And then they're finding interest in historical events or figures that they want to display in their home. And I just find...
Personal.
Yeah. just that connection that we seem to need, you know, like before it would like... We seem to need to have this connection to nature, and we also seem to need to want to talk about or explore a connection to history. So what is that? Is it like, is a person with the George Washington portrait, like, is that an ancestor of theirs, or are they, or are they just extremely patriotic, or are they a history teacher? you know,
these are all great questions,
right? And these are the questions I hope to pose by pointing them out to you as a viewer within my work. And just, again, you know, the different motivations, you know, sometimes it could be like a really personal thing if it's related to family or heritage, but then it might just be like, I want to look smart, you know?
I think that's a really big motivation.
I think
sometimes.
It is too. And I mean, I'm laughing about it. I'm not making fun of it. I find it fascinating, you know? And then we have obsessions, like one of my, a picture that I love in the book, this person has a collection of Jackie O memorabilia, and
yes.
She's just kind of obsessed with Jackie O. And I find that interesting. And she has these objects arranged in a room that is this like Pepto-Bismol pink color. It's not just finding the historical references, like the portrait of George Washington. It's also the fact that like he's hanging over a double bed in a bedroom.
That's weird. That's bonkers.
Right. So it's the context. I mean, it's like, yes, I find these objects that I find interesting in and of themselves, but it's really about where they are and why they are where they are and how they resonate, you know, with the other decor and chosen objects and all of that. So this brightly colored pink room with this bold patterned bedspread, and then, you know, she has tons and tons of books on Jackie and a Jackie doll and, you know, all these little things in the room.
All right, well, what does this mean? I have there was one time Dave posted a picture on social media of him in his house, and in the background there happened to be one of my self portraits, one of the women that we used to work with at Wellesley, that I used to work with, he still does work with, commented on the image, "You have a picture of Jim on your wall."
Oh my God, it's making me think. I always wanted to photograph in Dave's apartment, and I haven't yet. And I could have done that for Interior Portraits. It would be, you know, kind of meta for me to photograph Dave's apartment with the portrait of you. That's the self-portrait.
I don't know if it's still up there, but
yeah, that would have been good. Oh man, I missed an opportunity. Oh, and also because you're in the spacesuit, and that could be like a historical reference.
It's like, is that patriotism? Like, what is that?
Who knows? What is Jim's art?
Why
about?
Did you do this? What is your deal, dude?
Oh my God. Many layers. So many layers of art. I can't stand it.
It's really fantastic. In our recent texting, when I was trying to convince you to do the podcast, I mentioned a conversation that you and I had years ago at this point, where you were telling me about an experience you had at a portfolio review where you were putting together the first edits for a book before the book was even planned.
Yeah.
It was just the idea of the book. Like that was your goal. And I can't remember who the reviewer was or if that's important, but I remember you telling me that the reviewer asked you, why do you want to make a book? Like everybody wants to make a book. Why do you want to make a book? So why do you want to make books? Is it because you need to make the books, or is it for status, or for like what's up with wanting to make books? Why do photographers want to make books?
Well, I think there's so many reasons, and you just mentioned a few of them. I mean, I mentioned one of them, in my rambling about loving books.
Yeah. No, but I think that's a really good
I
reason.
think that's a good reason, is that I like to look at them, and part of that, again, is the sequence and the being able to go back to it and seeing new things, being able to own it. I mean, being able to have it. I own too many.
You own a lot of books.
Yeah, there's that, and that creates its own problems. But it's easier to buy a book than it is to buy the framed photograph, financially speaking. So I love those things about books. So that means, as an artist, I like to think about those things in my own work, that being the connection between images, the sequence. And one of the things I hope is true about my own work is that you can see new things in it when you look back at it. I have these little details that don't stick out necessarily at first. And I have had people mention to me, like, oh, I never noticed that thing before that's like actually important to how I see it now. I want to have my work be in that context.
Yeah.
I also, sure, I want the status and the prestige.
Hell
I
yeah.
mean,
Gotta get recognition somewhere.
exactly. And, a friend of mine, that who Bill Burke, who has published a lot of books and a lot of really important photo books that get a lot of attention, talks about like it as a legacy. Like, the book will be around well after I'm gone, hopefully, unless everybody goes at the same time, which, that could happen. But
Well,
sorry.
it's just funny. Like I in my news feed, for some reason, I think because when the new space satellite telescope, the Webb telescope was launched, I was reading a lot of articles about that. And now I get all this weird space stuff in my
Oh,
news
yeah.
feed. And every week there are at least three articles about asteroids heading towards Earth.
Yeah. Interesting.
Which is
Is
just
it?
like, dude, how many times can you write this article?
I mean, aren't they like training satellites to
Smash
get
into
them before they
asteroids.
head here? I don't know.
Yes. And I yeah, again, sorry for just derailing
No,
you, but
it's
it's
all
just,
wrapped up
but
in the
like
same. The existential dread. It's all existential dread, and that's a good motivator for making a book too. And it's a different way of, I mean, if you say there's a certain status to it, part of that is just it's a different way for people to become aware of your work and see your work. I mean, if I have a show somewhere,
Yeah, how many
some
people can
people will
go to the
see
show?
it. Right. But it's not the same.
No.
So, it's a way to get your work out there.
Yeah. Plus books are cool,
Yeah,
right?
and they're cool, and they don't hurt when you apply for being full professor. So there's that too.
No, I guess I guess that's a bonus.
Right. I was lucky that the first one came out right as I was applying for tenure. It didn't hurt.
It's a nice book too.
I like it. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for making it.
You're welcome. It did it for you, Jim Turbert.
When I said you were focused before, I was referring not only to the topic of your art and your dedication to that, but your focus on your career in general, like whether it's dealing with school stuff or gallery stuff or potential show stuff. I don't know if it's healthy. Like sometimes you seem a little bit too stressed out about
Oh my
stuff that maybe you
God.
shouldn't be stressed out about, but like you always seem to have some sort of career thing on your mind. And like, yeah, like I don't see you very often anymore, but every time I talk to you, you're always working hard on something. And I mean, that takes a lot of focus.
Yeah.
And you've been able to make books, you've been able to get gallery shows and other sorts of shows. And yeah, I don't know. I think that makes you a pretty successful person. Or at least as an artist, it makes you successful more, at least to some degree. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about it?
I think I'm incredibly stubborn. And I was just talking to a friend about this, that I'm incredibly stubborn, and I think, as you mentioned, there are downsides. past that. And I think there's upsides to it too. I think that a lot of what you could call success is due to just not giving up. I mean, I think, you know, on the teaching thing, I just was like, I just didn't give up. And I mean, it's easy. A lot of people don't give up, but there's such crazy stuff involved that I know plenty of really talented artists and educators who just were like, I can't do this anymore. And I don't blame them at all. And there was a lot of luck or good fortune in what I was able to string together, but I just was not going to give up. And I think a lot of it is, well, I'm going to say spite, but but not always, you know, like, you know, I already mentioned my father and you know, not necessarily being supportive, but I remember, you know, one thing he said to me when I was talking about going to grad school, he researches things to make his point. And he was like, under 2% of people who get their MFA end up getting a teaching job.
Where did you get that number?
I have no idea.
Is that accurate?
I feel like maybe it is.
I mean, that's really low number.
It's low. And I don't know what it is. Whatever it is, it's low. But like, because he said that, I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm not suggesting this as a way.
That sounds really healthy.
It's not.
No, it's. I mean, you got to have motivation from somewhere. It's not. I'm so. I said, yeah, whatever. Healthy, schmelthy. It's, you know, you get your motivation where you can get right.
And I mean, it's not. I mean, I'm making a joke about it. And I mean, obviously, it's not the only reason. And I do have like I just think an organic internal thing in me that wants to do something, and really wants to do it. But if somebody tells me I can't do it, that's going to make me want to do it more. And it just happened with a picture. I was on a shoot the other day. I mean, it was something silly. It was like, can I use this little prop and make it bigger in Photoshop to have it be an important part of the picture? And someone was like, no, that's not going to work. You can't do that. So what did I spend, you know, 8 hours on yesterday? It's working. It's working.
Yeah, it is.
You know, because I won't let it not work now.
Yeah, that's anyway. Really good.
And it's not the only reason, you know, for spite or whatever to prove my point. But I think it's going to be a good picture. Like, I wouldn't do it if I didn't think that it actually could be something good. That I'm stubborn that way.
Well, this is what I mean about the focus.
I'm focused. It's like maybe a nicer way of saying it.
I remember one time you were showing me test prints of something and you're like, look at this one and look at this one. What do you notice? I'm like, what am I looking for? You're just like, just tell me what you notice. Like you were basically wanted me to, like, you didn't tell me this, but you were looking for, like, if I could see the Photoshop.
Yeah. I feel so badly for my friends that I do that to. And now I have a lovely assistant, and all I do is put him through the ringer of this kind of thing. But that's why there's an acknowledgement section in the book.
It's nice to be acknowledged.
Yeah.
I feel like we're good. Do you feel like we're good?
I think so.
Thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And I don't know, maybe we could do it again sometime.
That would be nice. And just to chat.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
See ya.
That was Sarah. Super fun, right? Was it too arty for you? Photo people are probably sitting there saying, that was barely arty. It's a matter of perspective. I don't think it was too much or too little. I think it was balanced. There were so many great things about our talk that I almost don't know what to say, so I'll go back to my point about her being focused. She called it being stubborn, I call it being focused. How do you see it? Maybe because I know her, I look at pretty much everything she does as contributing to her need or desire to continue making photographs. She doesn't give up, and pretty much everything she does career-wise contributes to allowing her to continue making photographs. And she's accomplishing that. Thus, she's a successful person. Thanks for being on the show, Sarah. I hope to talk to you again soon. As I mentioned in the introduction, you can see Sarah's work on her website, sarahmalikoff.com. There's a page on that site that showcases her book, Second Nature, sarahmalikoff.com/books. Also, she's represented by the Howard Yezierski Gallery in Boston. Drop in there and buy a photograph, or just go to the site and look around. The link for that is howardyezierski.com/Sarah-Malikoff. Check the show notes for links and spelling. Full disclosure, I'm not represented by any galleries, but you can check me out on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube at Feel Free to Deviate. Follow, like, interact, tell all your friends. If you'd like to contribute financially, there's a donate page on feelfreetodeviate.com. You can see Feel Free to Donate in the menu. Or you may prefer going to buymeacoffee.com/feelfree. That's just feel free, no deviations. It's a quick, easy, and painless way to help offset the cost of running the show while simultaneously keeping Jim Turbert caffeinated, which costs more than you might think. Coming up in 2 weeks is Holly, or Yoris, I think. Holly's an actor, and a voice actor, and Yoris is a superstar DJ. Regardless of the guest, I will be here. Have a good one, two, or three. I hope they're all good. Thanks for hanging out with us. Goodbye.